cameras. We have Captain Grandjean from the Gresham Police Department to speak with us about their experiences with body-worn cameras. This is our third conversation. The first one was with the New Orleans Police Oversight Entity. Second was with the Beaverton Police Department, and now with our neighbors over in Gresham. Let's make just a quick introduction around the room since we have a short guest list today. My name is Vadim Mazursky, a Citizen Review Committee member. And Shayna.
Hi, everyone. I'm Shayna Pomerantz, pronouns she, her. I'm co-chair with Vadim on this committee and co-chair of CRC. And thank you so much for joining us today. I'm going to keep my camera off just because of the Wi-Fi issues.
Of course. And we have someone here from Representative Dexter's office. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Representative. You.
Sorry, I wasn't sure if you were calling on me or Lauren, but I'm Representative Dexter. I represent House District 33, which is Northwest Portland, including the Pearl District and Slabtown. Really glad to be here, and I use she, her pronouns. Thanks.
Welcome, Representative Dexter. And then someone from your staff is here as well, right?
Yes, thank you, Lauren Morrison, she, her pronouns. I'm Rep Dexter's Chief of Staff. Here to listen today. Thank you for having us.
Of course. And Mark Porras.
Hi, I'm Mark Porras, he, him pronouns. I'm a community member in Northeast Portland. I'm just curious. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Megan? Megan Grabowski, if you want to introduce yourself, you might be on mute right now, but feel free to make introductions and say who you are if you'd like. And then we have Portland Cop Watch. I assume Mr. Handelman, are you there with us?
Hi, yeah, this is Dan Handelman. I use he, him pronouns. I'm with the group Portland Cop Watch. And we have attended almost every CRC meeting since it was created in 2001.
Okay. And V. Nordine.
Hello. Hi. I'm the grants analyst from the Police Bureau, and I have a vested interest in how the body-worn camera policy comes together.
Okay, great. Glad to have you here. So, Captain Grandjean, let me open it up for you if you can make an introduction and then give us an idea about the body-worn camera program with the Gresham Police Department.
Sure, my name is Claudio Grandjean. I'm a captain at the Gresham Police Department, currently in charge of the Services Division. I was the program manager for our body-worn cam program. We got implemented, we were fully implemented January of last year, so January 2021, we reached full implementation. So we've been about a year fully implemented. It was a graduated implementation when we brought it in. We actually looked at it originally, I believe it was like 2014, might have been 2013, as we started to kind of do some exploratory work on it. The costs were prohibitive, and we just couldn't afford it, and the program was kind of stopped at that point. A few years later, we applied for a federal grant and were awarded that grant. And so we used that grant to implement the system that we're on now. And so it was a long process. And you know, you talk about involving stakeholders. There were more stakeholders than you realize. And behind every door you open, there's three more doors. And so it felt like progress was really slow because you had to slow down and make sure you were involving everybody. But we finally got it done, like I say, January of last year.
And can you give us a sense as to what the requirements are for that program from the standpoint of the police? Under what circumstances do they have to turn the camera on? When are they mandated to have the camera on?
Sure. Sure. So there's a statutory requirement. House Bill 2571 from 2016, I think it is. I might be wrong about the year, but that created some statutory requirements to put into your policy around body-worn cam. It's specifically like when you should turn it on. The policy states something to the effect, or I should say the law states something to the effect of, at minimum, officers should turn on when they've developed probable cause and until that contact is finished. We stepped it back a little bit because just to take some of the ambiguity out of it and just say every official police contact, that's what we put in policy, which would cover the statutory requirement. So every official police contact, you have to turn it on. And there's some carve outs, and well, I'm sure we'll work our way to that around privacy concerns and things like that, where we wouldn't turn them on. But that's what the policy says, every official police contact, until that contact is finished, then you turn it off.
And you raised the point that we've spoken with other individuals. What are the considerations with respect to privacy interests, whether it might be a minor or someone that's been abused or in a hospital or something along those lines?
Right. Yeah. You know, there's a recognition of you know, a lot of victims' privacy concerns or just legitimate privacy concerns. For example, if someone's reporting like a burglary, a cold burglary, not in progress, but like a burglary happened in my house and an officer were to show up to do an investigation, nothing is happening now, right? And you walk into their house with a camera on and the person says, you know, I really am not comfortable with you recording me inside my house. That's a legitimate privacy concern. And so the officer would you know, note that on the camera and then turn it off. So that's one like simple example. The more difficult examples would be like inside a setting in a hospital where sometimes we would go to contact perhaps like a DUI accident where someone is injured and you have to go contact somebody to make a statement. As you know, when you go to a hospital, you're going through a lot of areas and potentially contacting people that have nothing to do with your investigation. And so in those circumstances, you know, we've put in policy where officers can not turn the camera on until they've actually contacted the person that they need to talk to. And even then, if that person has, if it's not a suspect, like let's say it was a witness or a victim, then if they have legitimate privacy concerns, then the officers wouldn't turn it on. And then of course, in the case of like sex abuse victims, it's just not, it's almost, you could almost be re-traumatizing somebody, you know, by putting them on camera potentially to make a statement. And so we just left it at the officer's discretion. If the person is not comfortable being recorded, then just turn it off. It's more important to get the facts so we can do a good investigation than just to record something like that.
Another area that people have kind of risen as a topic that is of concern is the ability to edit the video, whether nefariously or otherwise. What sort of safeguards do you have in place so that people are not able to, or if you do have those in place, but are not able to edit the videos before they're reviewed or made public or given to the DA's office or something along those lines?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that was something that came up all along when we were meeting with community groups. That's a legitimate concern. And knowing that, virtually all the, I can't speak for all the vendors, because obviously I didn't talk to, but every vendor we spoke to, they have their cameras set in a way to where the only thing an officer can do is record an event and then upload it. They don't have the ability to alter a video or change a video. And then now videos can be deleted for specific reasons, but there is a very hardy audit trail that shows why it isn't, and someone has to provide an explanation for why a video would be deleted. An example of why a video would be deleted. The cameras, most of the cameras and ours do also have like a 30-second buffer. So the moment I make the decision to turn the camera on, it actually jumps back 30 seconds before I turn the camera on and it captures that video only. That's the reason why a lot of times when you see the videos, like on YouTube or something like that, there's a moment of just video with no audio, and then the audio kicks in. That's actually the moment when the officer actually turned the, you know, flipped the camera on. So one of the things we found, you know, again, it's because it's a new technology and it's new to us, An officer is going to the bathroom and he hears a call. Oops, turns his camera on and off he goes to the call. Well, the camera would have jumped back and caught him in the bathroom. Well, that's, you know, that doesn't need to be, you don't need to create a video for everyone to see later of that. And so, you know, that would be a legitimate reason to either delete that portion or delete a video if that's the only video created. But I'm just, you know, giving an example. But officers do not have the ability to go in and alter, change. It's not like you can do on your phone where I can create a video and then I have a built-in editor and I can alter the speed of the video, the frames of the video, take frames out, add frames in. All the things that you can do with your phone, you cannot do. You just don't have the ability to do it. It's not offered to you. The video is on your device, you dock it and it uploads and you no longer are able to do any of those things.
Okay.
Again, that's what the vendor that we have, but every vendor we tested, it was the same way. So I think because that's a legitimate concern that people have, any vendor is going to have that built in where there's no ability to alter videos on the fly.
And is your vendor Motorola?
Yes, we went with Motorola.
The next area I want to kind of converse with you about is who gets to review the videos, and I'm going to kind of split it up into three areas. One is internal, whether it's supervisors or whatever that might be. The next would be from DAs or defense attorneys' perspective, and then the third area would be public. And so internally, what sort of mechanisms do you have for people to review those videos, whether it be, for internal policy reviews or for disciplinary measures or for, use for in crime investigations?
So first thing I'd have to explain, I guess, is we went with cloud storage solution. When I explained that we first looked at this back in 2014, whatever, most of the vendors were doing some kind of in-house storage solution, which means you would actually have the storage, and a few of the vendors were doing cloud. When we got the grant that I mentioned, most all the vendors had moved to either a hybrid solution where some of it was in-house, some of it was in the cloud, or just a total cloud solution. We went with the total cloud solution. The reason that's pertinent to your question is how it's viewed, right? Because if it's a internal storage, then there has to be some security mechanisms in place for who can access that internal storage. When it's cloud, you have the same security concerns, but it's like somebody can go somewhere where the actual video lives and do anything with that video. It's off in the cloud, and so then whatever system that you use, in our case, again, it's the Motorola system, that they call it the vault. You can put in certain permissions depending on who the user is as to how much and what they can view. So what we have done is the officer, if I'm an officer that I've created a video, the only permissions I have are to my own video. I can't just willy-nilly look at any video that I want to look at. The only video I can actually look at is my own video. Now, a supervisor can look at the video of anybody they supervise, which of course would be important in the case of a complaint. If I'm a supervisor of an officer and someone complains about the officer, then of course I need the ability to look at that video and determine, you know, what exactly happened. And then we have the administrators who can look at all the videos. On a case-by-case basis, we grant that authority to investigators when we have a large crime and a lot of officers respond and they create a lot of video. We have an investigator who needs to curate and move the video for purposes of an investigative presentation. So in other words, all those authorities can be granted within the system. Mostly the cloud storage solutions we looked at have some kind of software like that where different permissions are granted. And then we have a civilian position, the person who oversees the entire program. And that's the person who they liaise on with the DA's office and let them know where things are. They check for audit, you know, they audit the system to make sure that the officers are properly tagging videos. They create redaction for public records requests. That person is basically the administrator of the whole system. So that's the kind of the internal, to answer that question that you're asking for. In terms of DAs, I think that was what your other question was, or how we would get things to the DAs and defense attorneys, et cetera. There's a lot of possible solutions to that. The one we went with, but since we're storing the videos in the clouds, we just granted access to our DA's office to that same cloud storage. So when an officer creates a video that is part of a criminal case, so it's evidence of something, then the DA's office just logs in and they look at the video, then they now have the video. And they're the ones who are doing the discovery for defense. So the defense would need to also obviously view the videos. And so they're the ones that share the video, because that's where the discovery lies anyways, within the DA's office. And then in terms of external viewership, then someone would have to come in and do a public records request. And then the person who oversees the program, the civilian person who oversees the program, would have to check the video, make sure there isn't a need for redaction, for some privacy concerns, then redact the video if need be and release it. There's also within the original bill that I mentioned before, there's some public records requirements as far as what you can ask for. In other words, you can't just go in and say, hey, I want all Bobby Warren Cannon video that every officer created between these dates and this dates. It has to be more specific than that.
Do you know what the fee structure is for those requests?
It's a good question. I should look that up. We do have within the public records request form, the fees are listed there. I don't remember what they are, but they're fees because it does require quite a bit of time and review.
And then in prior discussions, including with Portland community members, there certainly has been a difference as to when the police individually are able to review the video, whether it's prior to issuing a statement after a use of force event, let's say, or after issuing a statement or something on those lines. What's the policy in Gresham right now about when a police officer involved in, you know, I'll just say a shooting or something like that, can review the video prior to making any kind of statements or after?
So yeah, that is a pretty hot debate, not just in Portland, but as body-worn cams were coming into our consciousness, it's all over the country. There's debates on both sides of the issue. PERF, for example, Police Executive Research Forum and IACP both recommend letting an officer view the video before making a statement. ACLU recommends not to do that. And so everyone in between, there's different positions. Our current policy, and I also want to differentiate, you know, because the example you gave is like an officer involved shooting, can you view it? One thing to remember though is there's also just criminal cases that aren't, they don't rise to the level of officer involved shooting. It simply could be a DWI arrest or a shoplift, you know, where there's video footage, and maybe even some a lower level use of force. The question is, should officers view that footage before they write the report? Our policy is allowed for them to do that, to view the footage before the report is written. We do treat officer-involved shootings differently, only because just because the understanding of the scrutiny that's going to get, and also in consultation with the DA's office. And so on a typical, I'll take like a typical low-level case. So like I mentioned, like a shoplift or something like that. The officer creates a video when the arrest was made, and then they have control of that video only because that's the one they created in terms of being able to view it. They, by our policy, they can view it before they write the report. However, in the case of an officer involved shooting, officers don't normally just write a report. As you know, they get questioned by an investigative team. And so, part of our policy requires the sergeant on scene who responds to an officer-involved shooting to take camera and just make sure the officer doesn't have access to it anymore, and then hand it off to the investigators who then upload it and take care of the camera. And so they have control of the video itself. That way there's no even possibility for the officer to view it multiple times or any times until such time he's ready to give a statement. And then when the arrangements have been made, as they normally have a day or two later to do a statement, then the officer would come in and if the officer chooses to view the video, can view the video and then make a statement, or the officer can just make a statement if they choose to also.
Okay. One area of particular interest in Portland is the police oversight aspect. And so we have with us today Mr. Handelman, who's on a commission right now to form the board that'll eventually have a civilian oversight of the police bureau. And so I want to capture a little bit about some of the interests in making sure that police are accountable, that there's good oversight on their actions. So with respect to compliance, first I'll ask with turning on the cameras, have there been, to your knowledge at least, non-compliance issues within Gresham, either initially or currently, and what would be the ramifications of an officer that would go to an event and say not turn on their camera and not follow policy accordingly?
So we just did some random audits to answer that question, you know, what kind of compliance we're getting. One thing we found is early on, compliance is much lower than it is later. That's understandable because it's new technology. It's a new piece that we haven't incorporated into our normal routine. And so, and as a matter of fact, just recently, I went through some scenario-based training. And one of the things we did is we said, bring your camera so we can incorporate it into the training. And in many scenarios, I forgot to put my camera on. And here I am, the project manager. It was kind of embarrassing, but it just goes to show that, and this is a scenario now, when it's not a regular part of your routine, you can forget to do the little click. So there was an understanding early on that was something we're going to have to keep, you know, reminding people, make sure you turn your cameras on, make sure you turn your cameras on. So there were some scenarios early on where you have like three officers respond, two of them turned the camera on, one forgot. Or the officer that forgot maybe turned it on well into the event because they arrived, they were doing what they normally do. Oh, I forgot to turn my camera on. They put the camera on. So one of the things we do to ensure compliance is just regular audits and see, do we have an issue with compliance? There are some, both in the law and in our policy, there's some room for officers not turning a camera on under some circumstances. For example, if it's unsafe to do so, you come upon something that you have to act immediately. We don't want officers failing to protect themselves or members of the public because they're busy jiggling with a camera. And the law recognized that, that could be written into policy. So you're not going to get 100% compliance because there's some circumstances that understandably are not going to lend themselves to an officer putting a camera on right away. However, what we've done is just done regular audits to see how our departmental compliance is. I should have pulled that. I don't know where our last numbers are. And then if there's individual problems, then it would be treated as any other violation of a policy because it's policy to put it on. If you're not putting it on, then you're violating policy.
Okay. And there are some questions in the chat, and I should have said this earlier, but I'll speak with Captain Grandjean for a little bit, and then we'll open it up to just general questions. But I did want to follow up on one of the questions there is how often do these sort of audits occur?
Okay, sorry, I'm just reading the chat now. So the audits we do quarterly, we've begun to do them quarterly.
Okay. And then what is the scope and process for those audits?
So the audit looks at, like I mentioned, compliance. They also look at the tagging of the videos. And what I mean by that is there's a process. And once you've created a video, you need to tag, maybe not the right word, it's more like categorize what kind of video it is. So is this a misdemeanor criminal case? Is it a felony criminal case? Is it just a citizen contact, traffic stop, et cetera? So there's a series of categories that need to be, that the video needs to be categorized into. And so we look to see to make sure they're being properly categorized, which we call tagging. But you know, tagging has for social media has a different connotations. But it's really just categorizing the video and then entering in the proper case number or call number so that it can be found later. So the video can be found more easily. The video can be found anyway, but it can be found more easily, and so it's correctly found. It also helps the DA's office finds it. So we're looking for compliance in both of those things, as well as activating the camera when it should be activated, and then also for making the announcement. There's a requirement to make an announcement. This is a statutory requirement, and so our officers making the announcement as they're required to.
Thank you. And then, are there any other utilization in your department for reviewing cameras with respect to either just generally seeing a policy compliance or reviewing the videos, I should say, for policy compliance or policy development or just any kind of internal audits to see if officers are just generally interacting with the public in a adequate way or things like that, just checking in sort of like from a supervisory standpoint.
Right. So as far as just like random checks of contacts or interactions, we do not do that. We don't do it because that was actually, that's an issue that was prior to us ever even having cameras. That was an association, our police association, in one of the negotiations, put that into writing in the contract that we administration police can't use the any kind of technology to just do random checks. There has to be some kind of reasonable suspicion of something happening or some kind of something brought to our attention in order to do that. So under the current contract, we're not allowed to just do random checks. That being said, every use of force report that's written, we do check, so in other words, the sergeant who does the oversight of that will read the use of force report. When they're done with that, then they will look at the video to see if it applies, if it's the same, if there's any issues. And if any other policy violations are found during that review, those are addressed also. So we have, in some cases, there's a use of force. There's no issue with the use of force, but perhaps the officer violated another policy, then that different policy violation gets addressed.
I do have a few other questions, but I wanted to open up to community questions at this point in time. And if we have time, I'll follow up on those other ones. There's a couple more questions in the chat, which I'll get to. But first, let me just open it up for anybody that wants to perhaps raise their hand and ask the questions directly. If not, I'll read from the chat. Okay. So seeing none.
Nadeem, I actually have a quick question before we open it up. Thank you for coming, Captain. With regards to when you were talking about the camera clicking on, I've kind of been educating myself and understand that tasers are connected to the camera. So when you pull your taser from your holster, the camera clicks on. Is that something that you all, is that a product that you're invested in, or how does that work with?
So different companies offered what they call different triggers. And because Axon Taser is one of the companies that offers a camera, they do have something integrated like that with their Axon Taser where you can pull that and automatically comes on. But different companies offer all kinds of triggers. Like if you pull your gun out and the camera automatically comes on, or you put your lights on, your emergency lights on, and the camera automatically comes on, or you open a door and the camera automatically comes on. So it takes out of the officer the ability to turn the camera on and off. It just, these whatever triggers you program into the system, then the camera automatically comes on and off. And not every vendor does that, and there's different levels of that, but But what you're talking about, I think, is the trigger that one of the triggers that Axon offers if you have the Axon system. And there's pros and cons to doing it that way. You create a lot of extra video, which may or may not be a problem, but that's a lot of extra cost. So you have to consider the cost, because the big cost in this is storage. It's far more convenient for whatever IT system you have in place, particularly if you don't have the infrastructure in place to store all this. You're creating scads and scads of digital media evidence. So it's far more convenient to store in the cloud. It's also a lot more expensive. And so you have to consider cost also. Does that answer your question?
Yes, you did. And I'm curious, I don't know if you have knowledge of this, but I'm curious to know, because cost certainly does factor in. So one, because of a lot of the settlements that come with police departments and whatnot, I'm curious to know, has there been any research to kind of look into the offset of, the cost of settlements for police officer engaged shootings versus the cost of the cameras and the storage fees?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if anyone's couched it that way or looked at it that way. I know early on there were studies that indicated that both use of force and complaints went down with the onset of cameras. There's been other studies now that have come out since then that refute those original studies. So it's up to you as to which study what you want to believe, I guess. But I'm not aware of any studies that have, and we didn't do any like that, that couch it that way. Like, you're saving X amount. If I'm understanding your question right, you're saving X amount in potential payouts, but it's costing you on this end, and it ends up being a wash or whatever. I don't know.
And my last question is, a lot of the complaints that we receive through CRC oftentimes are something that doesn't rise to the level of officer engaged shootings, but more so just kind of the customer service element of it. A citizen feels that the officer was rude or made comments or did things. And so now it's kind of becomes a he said, she said, or they said kind of dynamic. And so I'm just curious to know how cameras have played a role in your process when following up on those complaints.
That's a great question. And I think you correctly point out that the vast majority of the issues fall in that category as far as just frequency. And the other issue about that, the cameras are great, but they have many limitations, particularly when it comes to use of force. If there's a single officer and he or she are using force, what usually happens, you see the interaction that leads up to the force, but then you see a bunch of jiggly, cloth, sky, ground, unless there's another officer who has a little more perspective. And so it doesn't really help like completely with how the use of force is actually happening, what the officer, the citizen is doing during this use of force encounter. Now, contrast that with what you're describing, like just a customer service issue. He was rude or she was rude to me or whatever. That's a lot easier to arbitrate with a camera than a use of force, because you're just a listener who's listening into the interaction. And so it's been a tremendous help for that. There's times when we've had to reprimand an officer, like, no, that wasn't professional. That's rude or whatever. There's other times where people make, allegations against officers saying they were rude or unprofessional or whatever, and they were completely professional and didn't do anything outside of policy. And it does help. It adds a whole lot of light to those, as you're saying, he said, or he said, she said type of thing, because you're really, if you don't have a video or audio, how do you measure the way an officer said something? That's really difficult. But if you have the video audio, you can say, well, that was that line that, that was pretty curt or rude or whatever, or not. So it's tremendous help to the things that we just see more frequently. if that makes sense.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to touch upon some of the questions in the chat here. One is, has the grant-related body-worn camera program evaluation by County DCJ been completed? And if so, what were the outcomes, and is it available by request?
I'm not familiar with that. I don't know.
Okay. And this is from the grant, the individual working on grants on behalf of the police bureau, I assume, to help with defray the costs, perhaps. Did you all get a grant initially to start up the body-worn camera program?
Yes, we got a federal grant for it.
The federal grant, okay. And I think Beaverton did as well. I think that's how their initial cameras were funded.
Beaverton and Hillsborough also. They got the same grant we got. I think Beaverton did a couple years before us, and then Hillsborough the next year, and then we got it the next year.
And then we have a chat question. Are there multiple tags? You talk about tagging the videos so it can indicate use of force as well as reasons for stop.
So yes, there are, and we can, well, if I'm understanding the question right, multiple tags, like more than one tag to an incident. I don't believe you can do that. I'm not 100% sure on that. It's a drop down and you select one of the tags. And I don't think you can do more than one tag on it, but I'm not 100% sure on that. And at least with the system we have, and I think most systems are this way, policy can dictate how many tags you can put it in, you know, unlimited tags, 100 tags if you want. Now, if you do that, the more tags you put, the more you complicate everything. And the more you complicate it, the more likely you are to get wrong tags. And so it's easier to make, you know, have enough tags to where it's robust enough and hard enough to capture what you've done, but not so many to where you overcomplicate it, to where you're just asking for human error to come in there and have a mistaken tag.
And then the next question is a two-parter, actually several parter. For the audits, how does that data inform practice? Do trainings and therefore costs increase, or is there a disciplinary action for improper tagging, not turning on the cameras? So that seems to cover several different things, but yeah, if you can address any of that.
So how does data inform practice? So one of the things we found when we were doing our regular trainings, both especially the trainings that are the higher risk, higher liability, lesser frequency type of trainings, so our driving training, our firearms training, our use of force training, initially, we weren't bringing the cameras into that. And that's why I mentioned that in the training scenario that I went to recently, we started bringing our cameras to all of that and to just, you know, have officers, you know, go on the firing range, you know, if it's a scenario and they're going through and they're using their firearm, yes, we're looking to see how they're shooting and if they shot properly, but also, did you turn your camera on? And we're just asking them that. And then they're reviewing the footage also to see what they captured. And we've incorporated that into all our training now, just so that it becomes more ingrained to turn on a regular basis. Let's see, what was the other part of that? See, is there a disciplinary action for improper tagging, not turning the cameras on? Yes, because it's in policy. So just like any other violation of policy, there'd be, you know, an escalating discipline. Let's see, did I miss another question there to train the work? There's a second part, a second question, I guess, with that. Do you want me to just address
that? Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. So it's saying, why is it practice that officers view footage before giving their statements when citizens do not have the same ability or access? I don't know if I agree with the way the question is worded, because it's saying, why is this a practice when citizens don't have that same ability to act? Well, if a citizen creates a video, they certainly have that same access. I don't know where this.
Let me get to the interest for Portland, at least. The Portland Police Association is in contract negotiations, and I think that this is one of the pieces that's being discussed. So with respect to officers being able to view footage before giving a statement or after, and those sort of things. And you might have answered this already, I think, but is that part of your collective bargaining agreement as to when they can access that?
So when we created the policy, we brought in the union, we brought in district attorney's office, our city attorney's office, and together we crafted a policy. But as I said, there's many arguments for letting an officer view the video, as there are for arguments for an officer not to view a video. And so, you know, some of the things to consider as far as, I guess to answer the question the person's asking, why can officers view the video for us? You want a good recall of the event. There's a lot of things that, especially in a traumatic situation, that affect your recall. Things such as the stress of an event or exertion, fatigue, lack of sleep, all these things affect your ability to recall. When you're in a traumatic situation, your body prioritizes survival and defense of yourself or another person over encoding information. That's just the way your brain works. And so if you want an accurate depiction of what happened, it would make sense to have an officer review the video first. That's the argument for. I understand there's arguments against also. And we certainly, you know, we kicked those around. We spent most of the time on our policy on this issue. And I will say for myself personally, I actually started on one side and went to the other. I initially was against officer reviewing the video. And after hearing both sides of the argument, I changed my mind. So, that's something for you all to work out in policy.
Thank you. And then I want to open it up to Mr. Handelman on the phone.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mazursky. So, Captain, just as a comment before I ask my question, the reason we feel very strongly that officers shouldn't view the footage before they write their initial report is that the Graham versus Connor standard says that use of force is based on what the officer knew at the time and not 2020 hindsight. So giving them the ability to have 2020 hindsight destroys the constitutional test of whether or not the force was valid. So I think you should rethink your rethinking on that and go back to and have the police association renegotiate on it, because it's not appropriate, in my opinion, and many other people's. But my question is you listed some carve outs, but you didn't say anything about, like, if an officer goes into a house of worship or if they're at a protest action where there's no suspicion of criminal activity, where the state law says that you can't collect or maintain people's information about their social, political, or religious affiliations without suspicion of criminal conduct. So do you have any kind of carve out for not like live streaming people's political points of view or religious points of view?
We don't have the ability to live stream at all. So the system doesn't allow for that. There is in our policy, there's a list of places to consider privacy concerns. Houses of worship is one, hospitals is another. So that is listed in there on any, you know, when you got to determine if you're going to turn the camera off because of reasonable privacy concerns or, you know, whatever the concern might be, it requires an officer's discretionary call. So, so we have to make allowances for that within the policy. So we listed a bunch, but you can't catch all of them, but some of them that we did list, we do have in our policy, the house of worship and hospitals, et cetera. And then, as far as your first comments, I am aware of Graham versus Connor, and there's many people that disagree with you. So that's not the only position. So that's just something for you guys to work out, I guess.
Thank you very much, Captain. I appreciate you participating in this. If there are any other questions that anybody has, please email me anytime, vadim.mazursky@portlandoregon.gov, and I will pass them along either to Captain Grandjohn or to any of the other people we've spoken to. I know we only have 15 minutes to discuss this very important broad topic, but I wanted to touch upon some of the issues that at least I've heard the community members specifically look into and require answers to. So hopefully we got some of that. We do have their policies, and there will be further discussions about how that might inform any policy development here in Portland. In the meantime, I do appreciate your time, Captain Grandjean. Thank you very much for participating, and it was a pleasure chatting with you. We'll do some internal housekeeping business here. So if you'd like to stay on and watch, feel free. If you want to disconnect and attend to other business, feel free as well.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having me, and I will go ahead and disconnect. I appreciate everybody.
All right, take care, sir. All right. Let me cede the floor. Shana, let me open it up for a discussion about going forward as to policy developments or otherwise whatever business we may need to. And sorry, I wasn't at the meeting last night, but fill me in.
No worries. And I just wanted to make sure, because I know we're coming into fall and folks are scheduling for holiday plans and kind of closing out the year. So we had a really wonderful presentation from the League of Women Voters and giving some of their feedback and suggestions to us. And so the conversation of standard review came up as being a pretty important concern that we should be looking into as a body. And so during our subcommittee sharing out, one of the things I asked was, you know, we had been discussing looking at the ordinances for IPR and CRC for the new oversight body, but given the work that we're doing right now with the body cameras and then also the conversation around the standard review, kind of looking at where should we be prioritizing and should this be a larger conversation that the body should be looking at, as well as with crowd control finishing their report, is there anything they'd like to assist with? So the general feedback that I got from Candace and a couple other folks, and folks who weren't there can go on our Facebook Live and watch the conversation. General consensus was that this conversation of the body cameras and the standard review is very timely and important. The biggest concern, I think, around the body cameras is that as far as feedback from the crowd control policy group was that a lot of the recommendations were given from over a year's worth of work poured into that report. And so the concern was we should be looking, and I think Vadim and I have talked offline that we want to spend maybe a couple of months kind of gathering information and kind of cycling back to a previous recommendation around body cameras to then in the beginning of the new year provide some kind of feedback recommendation to City Council around body cameras. So I don't think we're looking at a one-year process by any means, but the concern from the crowd control group was essentially that we should be mindful of the timeline because there might be some policy decisions or, you know, council decisions that come down the pipeline much sooner. And so some of that work might not be well spent. So that was something that was shared. And then having our body look at the standard of review and seeing how we can address that in terms of recommendations, and then delaying the work with the IPR and CRC ordinances to kind of focus on those two things. So I just wanted to put that out there because it does shift some of the previous conversations we've been having, but it could also be a really great opportunity to get more community involvement, specifically in the subcommittee to expedite the work.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with all that, Shana. As you probably know, about 3 years ago, when I was actually fairly new to the CRC, we went to all the commissioners at that point in time and the mayor and requested all of their assistance with changing the standard review to a different standard from what it is right now, or a less differential standard. And at that point in time, we didn't get one a city commissioner or mayor to actually champion that and try to push that through and get that city code change, which we may need. So that's an avenue to try to, you know, look at that maybe again and see if somebody would be willing to do that. I certainly went to at that point in time to Commissioner Hardesty's office and proposed that. And I know other people went to other offices and proposed that, but no one actually took that on. And it might be timely to do that again, since the new board will not be formed until, you know, it looks like 18 months to 2 years from now, if not more, there'll be a lot of hiring as well. So if we can change the standard to something that is more acceptable to the community and everybody, then that might be something to pursue. And as far as like trying to balance the workload, another thing I was thinking is having listening sessions for the body camera stuff separate from our first Thursday meetings, so we can kind of allow members, CRC members, to kind of pursue other interests. I know I spoke with Jessica and she had some policy recommendations that she wanted to pursue as well. So I mentioned that there might be ways to do that where we can hold Zoom meetings at other times just for a specific area, just like the body-worn camera, just like the in the past there were special listening sessions for crowd control. And we could do some of that as well. Does that sound good, Shana?
I'm fine with it. I just know that definitely will impact Irene and David as far as staffing us. So I just want to be really considerate of them. So I would even go so far as to say if maybe we could tag team on maybe, because with Zoom, we have the benefit of breakout groups. And so if we want to have kind of a listening session of one room is on standard review and another is on cameras, you know, so that way we're not overloading them, but you know, and if people want to go back and forth between rooms, we can do that. And just throwing that out as an idea, but I'm certainly open to any other suggestions. I think we also have the benefit of having Mr. Handelman, who's on the oversight committee and also coming in with the community perspective. So definitely, however we can get as much involvement as possible, yeah, would be great.
Yeah, there's going to be a way, I'm sure. Like I said, this is the last of the direct listening sessions with police bureaus that I was going to have. If anybody has other police bureaus, we can certainly continue that, but that's the only one on my agenda. And now it'll come down to actually meeting with community members and CRC individuals and kind of delving through the policies and the testimony that was given or the questions that were given to help as well, to help form any kind of recommendations that we might have or just general thoughts. It doesn't even have to be recommendations, you know, here's the main points that should be considered type of thing as well. And so we'll look into that. Mr. Handelman, I see your hand is raised.
Yes, thank you. You know, I remember Mr. Khan went through all the protocols for the CRC as part of this work group. And I thought that everybody in the work group also read through those protocols. But last night, the case of the retired police sergeant came back to the full meeting as a report from IPR, where the protocols say that when that report came back, you were supposed to hold a supplemental hearing. And I'm very troubled that when I raised that in public comment last night, so nobody seemed to realize or feel like, oh, well, we should probably hold the hearing that's required of us by our protocols. I thought you should know that since you weren't at that meeting last night.
Thank you, Mr. Handelman. I will watch the meeting, hopefully by the end of the day today when the work concludes. Speaking of which, I do have to run off to my day job. Thank you so much, everybody, for being here. This is, in my opinion, important work. I think this will definitely be something that Portland will be visiting either in the fall budget bump or at the full budget down the road with respect to looking at this and seeing how we can institute body-worn cameras. And if so, I think our work will be very timely here. So I appreciate everybody coming here and providing questions and listening. And please join us later down the road when we'll actually be rolling up our sleeves and looking at all the different policies and trying to see what fits best for Portland. Thank you all.
Hold on. Because is Mr. Handelman still here?
I'm still here.
Okay, good. I appreciate you bringing that up. And I share your concerns. I don't want you to think that silence was apathy. I think some of us just had a lot that we needed to process in that moment, because again, I think this goes to the larger issue in terms of understanding protocols and how we're being advised. So that I know for me, that's a point of also going back. So your presence is very important for that accountability piece. But I just want to say that that was a very big concern for me coming out of that meeting, and I don't feel like we handled it well. And I look forward to revisiting it. So it'll definitely be something that I recommend to come back to the agenda to be discussed.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Have a great day.